Praise the Lord, and well done, Annika. That was a long psalm. Well done. Thank you very much, Benders, for helping out with the service today. I don't know if Annika had a harder time with that 45-verse psalm or Sam had the harder time coming up here cold and reading the call to worship, but thank you to both of you. Have you guys seen The Matrix? Anyone like The Matrix? Yeah, I like them sort of in descending order, where first was the best and second was okay, and then the third was a colossal disappointment. But anyway, in The Matrix, the main enemy is a guy by the name of Agent Smith. I have a picture for him that should come up on the screen here. Agent Smith is Neo, the protagonist, the hero. He's his arch enemy. And I think that I have something in common with Agent Smith. Well, more than just sort of a pinched face and receding hairline. And I look really good in sunglasses. I have something in common with him. In the movie, Agent Smith in the second one starts to go around and clone himself. He starts attacking people, and he turns those other people into versions of himself. He actually goes right up to them, and he shoves his arm right into their chest, and before your eyes, it goes from that person's face into another version of Agent Smith. And so before you know it, there are a whole bunch of Agent Smiths all over the place. They start attacking Neo and so on. And I think that I have that same type of power, believe it or not. I can turn anything in my world into something about me. Do you have this power? Your kids are sick, and they've been sick for a couple of nights, and suddenly it's not so much about that sick kid as it is about how it's currently impacting me. Do you have this? Can you relate? What about you're driving down the street? I'm driving down the street, and all of a sudden it's brake lights. And I have no idea how long it's now going to take me to go where I need to go. And there's a car accident up ahead, and it's not about those poor people who are in this car accident. It's about how it's going to impact me. We find more subtle ways that this thing shows up, this feature of our life shows up all over the place. Maybe you have employees, and you love your employees, you take care of them, but you love the way that when they succeed, it reflects well on you. Or as a parent, and your kid succeeds, and suddenly it reflects well on you. And what was at some point about someone else out there has now become about me. I have this power. I'm preaching to myself, and maybe you can relate. That is why we are in the Psalms. Because this power that I have of making everything else in the world about me shows up in my prayer life all the time. I sit down to pray, and it has nothing to do with anything else in my world except me. Because that's where I default. That's where I land. So I pray far too much about myself and the troubles that I'm facing and the things that I want and so on. And the Psalms help us to recalibrate our prayer lives. Certainly, there's a ton of stuff about me in the Psalms, and they do teach us how to pray and to engage with our own lives before God. But there are other Psalms that take the focus completely off of ourselves, and this is a really, really healthy thing for people like me, and probably people like you too. Because there are just aspects of our prayer lives, a healthy prayer life, that we would forget about if we just prayed about the things that came to our own minds. I would rarely, if ever, pray for justice if I wasn't reminded to in the Psalms, if I wasn't actually praying the Psalms. I would rarely offer God worship one-on-one on my own. But you know what? The Psalms do that. But I'm too focused on myself. And so that's why we are encouraging us this summer to actually dig out your Psalms and pray them. Offer to God the words that he has said. These are good prayers. This is how you learn how to pray. And that's why we're focusing on the Psalms this summer. And today's psalm is one of those psalms that's going to make up for our lack because we focused on other areas. So, you heard this psalm tell the story of God's interaction with his people over hundreds and hundreds of years. And even this psalm that doesn't really look like a prayer becomes part of Israel's prayer life. And it becomes part of their worship experience. And so that's why we're getting into it today. The opening verses, they're just a call to worship. And that's actually what we use this morning in our call to worship. And so after the call to worship, starting at verse 12 and then going beyond there, it starts recounting this story of how God has actually interacted with this people. So verses 12 to 44 retell this story. And it's actually really important in our own prayer lives that we retell this story. And we're going to find out why in this psalm. It starts with a covenant to Abraham. God makes a covenant with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so recall this story to mind. Abraham gets called out of a place called Ur, which is sort of pre-Babylon, far, far, far away from the promised land. God calls him and he sends him into what will be Palestine and the promised land. And there is absolutely no reason why God should have done that. It's simply a gift of grace that God offers to Abraham. You are doing something over there, Abraham, but I'm actually going to make you part of my plan. And this is a gift that God offers to this nobody. He's an absolute nobody. Now, what does God offer Abraham? It's two main things. Call him out. We interact here. Children, very good. And what's the second one? Land. Land and children. Now, when Abraham dies, how many children does he have? Two. Yeah, and really only one counts in a way, at least according to this story, right? And how much land does he have? Burial plot. He's got the whole country and no one else knows it. He gets a burial plot. That's it. That's an interesting way that God works, isn't it? Interesting way that God works. But at the same time, God was kind enough to include Abraham in his story. In fact, God doesn't just include him in his story. God makes a covenant with Abraham, doesn't he? He makes him a promise. God obligates himself to this guy that he has called. And you know what? God has obligated himself to you too, to us. He's obligated himself to us. That's part of what we celebrate here, this new covenant. But God makes the first covenant with Abraham, and he obligates himself to fulfill the promise and to look after his people in the meantime. So God promises this land. We call it Palestine. They called it the Promised Land. It was the land of Canaan. And all they inherit are their burial plots. But before that, the psalm goes on to celebrate the fact that God not only calls and promises and offers to give this to Abraham, but that he protects Abraham and his family along the way. Abraham is an immigrant. He's coming from a foreign land. And God's going to make sure that he wanders in around the land that he's giving him, that he's never going to inherit except his burial plot. But God protects him the whole time. He protects him against foreign kings. He protects him against the elements. And then eventually they have children. But then there's a famine that shows up, right? The promise starts to be fulfilled, and then a famine shows up. So let's go back to that story again, just before the famine. Abraham has, what's Abraham's son? Isaac. Who's Isaac's son? Jacob and Esau, right? The line goes through Jacob, though. Then Jacob has how many sons? 12. Very good. Now, the psalm is now going to focus on one of those sons, Jacob's son, Joseph. And that's what the psalm is going to recount. Joseph goes down into Egypt, doesn't he? How did Joseph get to Egypt? Call it out. Slavery. He gets sold into slavery. By whom? His brothers. Why? They were jealous. Why were they jealous? He was his father's favorite. What does his father give him? Coat of many colors, right? Showing that he was his favorite son. Do you know why Joseph was the favorite son? Because of his mother, because Jacob had two wives, and he only liked one of them. And he showed favor to that wife and to his son. And so his brothers are jealous of the relationship that Joseph has with Jacob. Do you see the way that sin has just worked its way through this entire story that we have just recounted? You see that favoritism, sold into slavery. That's how Joseph gets to Egypt, because his brothers sell him out. They want to kill him, and then they sell him to make money instead. They do that because of Jacob's sin. And what does this text say about how Joseph gets to Egypt? God sent him. So when things are going wrong in your life, because of other people's sin or your own, God can still be at work. God can still be at work. God might. God very well probably is still at work in the circumstances that you find yourself. He sent Joseph ahead. He was working behind the scenes, in spite of the fact that, in fact, Joseph was a brat, right? Rubbing it into his brothers' faces that he was the favorite and that they were going to bow down to him because he'd been given some dreams and so on. I mean, this psalm reminds us that God can work with the most unlikely heroes. Completely unlikely, completely sinful. That's us. I find that really encouraging. So Joseph rises to power in Egypt, and his family comes down to Egypt because Egypt is the only place in the world that has food. There's a famine throughout the Promised Land, so Jacob and his sons and all of their families come down into Egypt, where Joseph has risen from prison up to second in command in the land, because that's what God made possible. So they're feeding their families there, and their families multiply. They become known as the children of Israel, right? And that's where Genesis ends and Exodus starts. The people multiply, they go from a relatively large family, and they become a nation. And what happens? What does Pharaoh do? Pharaoh's not too happy with these people, so what does he make them? Slaves, right? And the action intensifies, and they become slaves in Egypt. And so God sends two more unlikely heroes. Who are they? Moses and his brother Aaron. Very good. And then the plagues come, right? And the action starts to intensify. And for some reason, although our psalm has covered like just generation after generation in just a few verses, suddenly it slows down and it goes through the plagues one at a time. It names 8 of the 10 plagues for some reason. I don't know why 2 are left out. I don't know why it went through all 8 of these other ones, except that there is an emphasis in this text on what God has been doing, and it shows up. It's even more emphasized when it comes to the plagues. He did this. He sent that. He made them. He led. He fed, and so on. And so that's why I think this psalm slows down and actually looks at the plagues, because God is at work. And the people here learn that God is at work and that he is their savior and that he is their protector. They learn about how God hates oppression and loves justice. There are some things that this people needs to learn, and the only way they're going to learn them is if they are experiencing God at work in their midst. So God brings them out of Egypt. They come out of Egypt safely, and he starts to lead them through the desert. God didn't just sort of drop them at the side of the highway and tell them, go find the promised land. Here's a compass. That's not what he does. He leads them by the hand all the way to the promised land. He provides them with something to lead them, the pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. He protects them from their enemies. As they're wandering through this land, people are attacking them. Prophets are prophesying against them. They're trying to curse them, and they are having to tiptoe through enemy territory and sending people ahead saying, can we please go through your land, and so on. And it's really dangerous. They're wandering through the desert, but God brings them through all of that, and this text makes that explicit, that he led them through the desert, and he brought them safely to the promised land. And he fulfills the promise that he made. And that's what this psalm celebrates, that he fulfills the promise that he makes. And what does verse 45 say? You'll see it up there. God kept his promise in order that these people might make a response, that they might respond in a certain kind of way to God. This psalm has taken verses 12 to verse 44 to recount this story of God did this, then God did that, then God. And like God is just the subject of all of these verbs, just over and over and over again. God did, God sent, God led, and so on, all the way through. And then we get this little footnote right at the very end that says, so that, he did it so that his people might respond to him with obedience. One commentator whom I really like, his name's John Goldengay, he says, it would be an exaggeration to say that the whole point of recounting that story is to say that therefore people need to be obedient. That would be an over-exaggeration. But the psalm can put 95% of its emphasis on the grace of God. God did this and God did that for them. But it has to make clear that a response to grace is still required. 95% of this psalm is all about what God has done. 5%, right at the end. Here's our response. We're going to actually talk about response next week. But this week, I want to dwell on that 95% of what God has done for us. What he has done. Because it's so much. So what if my prayer life this week, and what if your prayer life reflected that percentage just this week? What if even 50% of my prayer life was all about what God has done and less about the me, 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 like Agent Smith? That would be a good thing, wouldn't it? It would start to right some wrongs in terms of the overemphases that I have in terms of focusing on myself. What if 95% of my prayer life this week was actually about the story of God? And not just this story, but what God has done for me in my life. Now, I've shared some of that with us before. A couple of weeks ago, I shared one particular story. But like, God has done things in my life, and they have to become part, this psalm is teaching us that they have to become part of my ongoing prayer life with God so that I can remember what he has done for me personally. Because it reminds me of who he is and how much he loves us. Second application. The story of God with his people is never about things were really good and then they got even better. And then they got better after that and better and better and better. It just good to great. The story of God's people is just never like that. I'm sorry. Like, your life, my life, the lives of the people in this story is all about things were really hard and God brought us through. And then we encountered this next really hard thing and God was faithful to us and he brought us through and he made us this promise and so on. And God's continuing faithfulness in the midst of a whole lot of trouble. I don't know about you, but I don't think character really gets built on good to great. But when he brings us through something, that's where character gets built. So, you know, when you are experiencing what Abraham is experiencing, wandering and waiting for God to make good, when you're Abraham, when you are like Joseph in prison and you feel helpless, and you don't know when you're going to get out of whatever situation you're in. When you feel like you are Israel being oppressed. When you feel like Moses dealing with recalcitrant people in the desert. When you find yourself in this story. Don't forget. That's where God's at work. That's what this whole story has been about. Right there in the midst of the problems, we find out when we read this psalm that that is where God is at work. How does Joseph get down to Egypt, right? That's where God is at work, even in the midst of the trouble. Lastly, the people who wrote this psalm were not the people who went through the desert. They were not the people that were led by Moses. They were not the people that were experiencing the plagues. They were not the people that took the promised land. They came much, much, much later. In other words, the people that wrote this psalm and eventually included it in their corporate worship are exactly the same type of people as you and me. We weren't there. They weren't there either. They didn't experience it. But this psalm is telling us that we stand on the shoulders of those who have come before us. Our present literally stands on the shoulders of the past, obviously. You are here today because of this story. You are here today because of what God has done with his people. And that's why this psalm is included in the Psalter, because of the celebration, the opportunity for celebration that recounting the story gives us. It gives us an opportunity to celebrate who God is and what he has done. You would not be you apart from this story, because there's no cross apart from this story. Apart from what God has done with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and the promised land and the people and so on. We're not here. Like, In fact, Western society would be entirely different, but that's too broad to make an application for. But you and I would not be here today. The good things that you enjoy about your life would not be possible without this story. This is a cause for celebration. This is why we remember it, because this is what God has done for his people. And look around. He has been faithful to the people to whom he has obligated himself. Hasn't he? Therefore, praise and thanksgiving. So let's take a moment. Instead of doing Q&A, what if we took 30 seconds to reflect for just a little bit on what are some of the things that God has done for you personally, for us corporately, whether as a church or the church, most broadly speaking. Let's take 30 seconds and let's just call out some answers after that. Go ahead and take 30 seconds to reflect on that. Okay. Where has God shown up? In your life personally, in our life corporately, in our world. Call it out. What has God done for us? What can we celebrate? Hope. Yes, hope because of Christ. We are not here apart from what Christ has done. And that offers us hope, both because of what he's done and because he is coming again and because he's at work here in the meantime. Yeah, wonderful. What has God done for you? He has blessed you with family, right? Not everyone can receive that blessing, but he has given you a blessing. That's wonderful. Every 500 years, God has a garage sale. What does that mean? So Dennis has been saying that God is at work in history. So he's referencing that every few hundred years, it seems like there's a turnover in how the church comes to understand who God is and how it needs to interact with society. So whether it's the Reformation, which we're coming up to the 500th anniversary of the Reformation this fall, where Martin Luther really did change the way we do church. And we stand in that tradition. There have been certainly some horrible things that came out of the Reformation, but there have been some wonderful blessings as well, and it was a necessary critique, and some good things came about it. And even where there were the horrible things that happened, God stuck with his people through it, didn't he? He's been faithful. What else? What's God done? Sarah said, God has strategically placed this church in this community for this time. Wonderful. The church is still here after 30 years. Most of the people are different, but something has continued, and probably it has continued because God is still actually interested in doing something with us here. And that's just a basic assumption of why we continue to gather here, because God is at work. And there is potential for him to continue to be at work in spite of the troubles that we have gone through, because every church has trouble, because every person has trouble, and a church is a whole group of people. What else? Lisa?
He provides for our needs.
He provides for our needs. What needs come to mind? Lisa's been sharing really honestly about how God has met the needs of their particular family in some really awesome ways, as they have gone through really hard times, and that God has been faithful to them. That's wonderful. And Ben is saying that there is Christian fellowship that is available. You know, some of you are not from this church and you're visiting here today, but you are welcome, and you are welcome at this table because of what God has done, what Christ has done at this particular table. And he has made us brothers and sisters that can work together, like Ben has said, beyond just this church, beyond this denomination. God has been at work. God has been at work even in those things we talked about that looked really challenging. You know, the church has a lot to answer for. Absolutely. Residential schools, colonialism, right? But God has been faithful to his people in spite of the mistakes that we made. God continues to be at work. And he is at work in your life. He's been faithful. Let's celebrate that in our prayer lives this week. Let's reflect on what God has done in this story and as it points to the ways that he is at work in our world in the same types of ways. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your faithfulness to your people. You have been at work on the world stage and behind the scenes, and we're only here today because of what you've done. Thank you for the history of your activity with your people. Thank you for the grace that we see in your call of Abraham. You're protecting Joseph. You're sending Moses, your rescue of your people, and your provision for their needs. Thank you for the way you continue to call and protect and send and sustain and provide for the people whom you've chosen because you love them. May we respond with grateful obedience. Amen.